Mr. Chair, on 2752, we have Reed and I testifying in the
paper. Okay, so you'll start.
I want to wait until Reed comes.
Oh, is he not here? Well, I don't want to wait. That's the problem. He'll get here when he gets here. All right. House Committee on Revenue for April 2nd, 2015 will come to order. I understand that there are some people whose schedules require them to be elsewhere soon, so we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2752, a bit out of order, but that's as it is. Chris, do you want to give us the
good afternoon
update,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee? House Bill 2752 deals with the R&D credit. It modifies the credit so that it would be refundable in tax years for corporations when they have Oregon sales of up to $1 million. And the bill would also increase the maximum tax credit from $1 million to $2 million. These changes would apply to tax years 2016, and the current sunset date is not affected.
Very good. And Representative Davis, did you want to be heard?
I did.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative John Davis. I'm happy to be here, and we'll hopefully soon be joined by Representative Reed. Representative Bentz, would you like to join me?
No.
We'll be joined in a moment by Representative Reed to ask your support for House Bill 2752, which makes alterations to the research and development tax credit. As we know, innovation plays a critical role in Oregon's economy. It's been a legacy for many decades now. In the early 1980s, Oregon was in the midst of the worst recession in our history, and timber harvests, which were previously the basis of our state's economy, were on a steep decline. It felt like we were in a free fall and did not have any place to go. That's when our governor laid the framework for a new economic development approach that would leave a lasting impact on the community for years to come. And that economic development approach was focused on the idea of innovation. And numerous measures were passed in the 1980s and 1990s to encourage and to implement innovation in the state of Oregon, one of which were precursors to the research and development tax credit. Today I'm here to advocate that we continue the legacy left behind by our previous leaders, and the research and development tax credit has already supported billions of dollars in private sector investment in critical fields of innovation, spanning from aerospace technology to agriculture and bioscience. My interest in this bill, as we've heard it many times, and I believe it was just last session, or was it 2013, when we extended the research and development tax credit, is to make it more usable for our small and emerging companies in the state of Oregon. We know, and I know, and have spoken with numerous companies that have availed themselves of the application for the research and development tax credit, but because they are new and emerging companies, currently have no tax liability that they can take advantage of. And essentially, the tax credit sits dormant and expires and is never used for its intended benefit. And that is the primary focus of where I'm going with this bill, is trying to direct its impact on small and emerging companies in the state of Oregon who are making research and development activities in the state of Oregon that are directly tied with innovation, making this credit usable for them and making an impact on our economy. With that, I will turn it over, perfectly timed, to my friend Representative Reed to go a little further with that concept.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Davis. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I'm happy that we're hearing House Bill 2752. I've spent a lot of time thinking about, reading about, working on economic development, and I think innovation is one of the three pillars that really help an economy grow. We have We have made significant investments over time in innovation in a lot of different forms, and I think this bill represents a logical and effective option for us to pursue, and I hope we will. As I suspect Representative Davis already mentioned, one of the key elements to this bill is making a portion of the credit be refundable for smaller businesses and startups with less than $1 million in Oregon sales. There are lots of examples of those companies that are poised to make really significant contributions to the economy as they make progress in developing their new technologies, their new products, and so on. So I think this is not only a potentially really effective policy on its face, it also sends an important message to angel investors, to venture capital, to entrepreneurs who want to make those advances in their own businesses. And it's a unique opportunity for us. I hope we'll be able to move it forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. We'll go on to our other witnesses. I have four yes and four no, so I'm going to call you all up, and you can figure out who wants to go first. Jeff Newgard, Mark, boy, I'm going to do it, aren't I? Modesky, DJ Vogt, maybe, and Beth Cook. Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Newgard, representing the Smart Growth Coalition. Our members are technology and heavy manufacturing corporations here in Oregon, and we are proud to be here today in support of House Bill 2752. During the recession of the early 1980s, Oregon experienced a very sluggish economic recovery. Like Representative Davis said, that was because of our reliance on the natural resource industry, and also on the declining timber harvest. At the time, Governor Vicatia understood that Oregon's economic troubles would continue to linger if action wasn't taken. That's when he unveiled a new economic development strategy that encouraged diversification of the economy. He advocated that adjustments be made to the tax code that both opened the doors to the international community and encouraged targeted investments. It worked. The R&D credit has successfully driven the creation of thousands of jobs, billions in private investment dollars, and downstream spending and support for the research industry. The credit anchors companies performing R&D now and provides incentives to attract other companies to Oregon. Without this important credit, some of our premier companies here in Oregon would certainly be wooed to greener pastures. As a millennial, I can't tell you what it was like to live during the recession of the 1980s. But one thing that I can tell you is that I grew up in a generation where innovation wasn't simply just a buzzword. It was part of our very fabric. And today there are students going to college specifically to be innovators. There are students that are going to college to go and innovate the next generation circuit breaker, to be able to go and discover the very first quantum computer. There's no reason why these discoveries can't happen here in Oregon. House Bill 2752 is designed to strengthen the R&D credit for every innovator in Oregon. Currently, the credit is not capable of being fully utilized by small businesses and startup companies when they are in their most fragile state. This bill is an opportunity for Oregon to invest in them by expanding access to this incentive, by making the credit refundable for companies that are making less than $1 million in Oregon sales. This will allow them to reinvest in R&D activities by hiring new employees and purchasing new equipment, and to help them bridge the gap between research and production, generating new revenues for state services. The bill would also restore the credit to its previous cap of $2 million, sending a message to the global business community and angel investors throughout the world that Oregon understands that innovation is the future. The Smart Growth Coalition urges your support of this critical step forward in promoting Oregon's innovation economy.
Thank you. Go ahead. Whoever's next.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Mark Modesky, and I'm the tax director for Tektronix. Our company is a member of the Smart Growth Coalition, and I'm here today to voice my support for House Bill 2752, which I believe that if enacted will make Oregon more attractive for increased investment in R&D activities. Oregon's innovation community has grown significantly over the past several years. While the semiconductor industry is probably the most recognizable, innovation is occurring throughout nearly every sector of Oregon's economy, from technology and manufacturing to agriculture and the biosciences. Although many of us in the innovation community compete over workforce and market share, we are also dependent on one another. Whether by choice or necessity, our success is often contingent on collaborative relationships. For example, recent advances in the semiconductor industry increased Tektronix's ability to develop new and improved test measurement and monitoring equipment for our customer base, who are mostly design engineers. In several cases, the very equipment that Tektronix manufactures has been used by engineers in the semiconductor industry to design and produce the next generation of computer chips that we use today. The research and development tax credit is an important tool for companies in Oregon, especially those companies that are highly innovative and have many choices as to where to place their employees who create their valuable intellectual properties. The honest truth is that we live in a very competitive global economy, and businesses do consider various alternatives, both tax and non-tax incentives, when determining future investments. The research tax credit may not seem like a very big incentive to some, but for those of us inside the finance organizations of companies who are required to prepare financial models and assist in locational decisions, it is very important. Some of you may not be aware of the mechanics of the computation of the research credit. The credit is not, quote, free. A company must incur qualifying research expenditures in the current year that exceed a base amount before obtaining any amount of a research credit. Expenditures in the determination year that do not exceed the base amount do not generate any amount of a research credit. Also, most of the spending that qualifies for the research credit comes in the form of wages paid to employees in Oregon who are engaged in performing qualified research activities. So this is very much a broad-based Oregon jobs incentive. House Bill 2752 is an opportunity to improve the tax credit on two major fronts. First, making the credit refundable, as we've heard, allows the research credit to be accessible to small businesses and startups. This cash inflow will help boost spending on research and development when these companies are in their most fragile state. Second, expanding the tax credit to $2 million and restoring it to its prior limit encourages new investments in research-related activities here in Oregon. I believe that if enacted, House Bill 2752 will both attract and retain innovative companies here in our home state. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is DJ Vogt. I represent the Oregon Business Association. And the OBA has membership of nearly 300 companies from across the state, ranging from the very largest employers in the state to very, very small employers. And we stand here today in support of House Bill 2752. The OBA has long been a supporter of the R&D tax credit and allowing it to go up to $2 million, which it was previously before the 2009 recession. We also very much support the change to making it refundable for small employers. We think this is a very positive change, allowing companies who are doing true innovation but may not be at the scale as some of our larger members, but they still are innovating, and we would like them to take advantage of such incentives that the state can offer and help them grow to potentially become those larger employers like the gentleman sitting next to me with Tektronix. So with that, I'll keep my remarks short. Stating for the record, OBA strongly supports 2752. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Beth Cook, and I'm here today on behalf of the Technology Association of Oregon. TAO is comprised of companies from throughout Oregon, large and small, including many startups within the entrepreneurial ecosystem. Many of our members are currently spending significant resources on their R&D, activities in Oregon. However, because they are not selling a product, because they're not to that phase yet, they do not have the tax liability to claim the credit against. This bill creates an opportunity for our members to reinvest their credit into their innovation activities. And this, for the smallest companies, this is really going to mean hiring additional workers and providing new equipment. These dollars are going to be directly impacting these new young companies and their ability to get to the next phase. This is going to help them bridge that gap between research and actual production and selling their products. This measure sends a strong message to angel investors throughout the country and the world that Oregon wants their business. Startups in general are innovating the next generation of products and processes, and we really gain significantly when these companies are based here and we're drawing in additional talent, we're drawing in additional resources and scaling them inside Oregon. House Bill 2752 will help attract greater investments, both from existing businesses and out-of-state businesses looking to expand their operations. And I just urge you to support, and I will also keep my remarks short. Thank you very much. Well, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Baker Peterson, please.
So I don't know if this is a question for the panel. It might be a question for staff, but what kind of R&D activities qualify for it? What are the business activities that qualify for this R&D tax credit?
I think several years ago there was a specific carve-out under the Oregon rules for what businesses qualify. Today I think it links up with federal rules. So there's a multi-part test as to what qualifies, but as you might suspect, it is innovation. It can be in many different industries, for instance, in manufacturing or agriculture, bioscience, et cetera. But one of the prima facie tests that you're doing qualifying R&D, of course, is whether what you're doing is patentable. If you can obtain a patent on it, the IRS says that, yes, you're doing qualifying research. And at least in our industry, with Tektronix, we have a patent pool that exceeds, 800 U.S. patents. So we have been given blessing that our work is qualifying. But there are many examples of out there as to what can qualify for the credit.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vega Peterson. I do know that in the federal IRC statute that there is a list of kind of the different categories of spending that a company can do. I'll make sure to get you a copy, and anybody, I can send it to the rest of the committee as well, just as
I think
FYI.
You send it to the committee administrator, and they'll distribute it for us. Thanks.
Can you follow up?
Yes, please.
And then this is a question again. A lot of this is making sure that Oregon is a competitive state with other compared to other states in attracting businesses. So what's other states do? Is this something that all 50 states have, or what, when we're looking at attracting businesses, what is this in terms of the environment that other states are doing? Mm-hmm.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vega Peterson. The last time I checked the number, which I'll admit was about 6 months ago, there was 37 states that had a research and development tax credit. There's also the federal research and development tax credit, which tends to be a kind of a political ping pong every year. It goes back and forth in the negotiation process for the budget. The last time that it was updated was for December 31st, 2014, for the last fiscal year. And there are ongoing discussions as the budget procedure goes on right now in D.C. on what's going to happen next.
Yes.
And how many have the deduction?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vega Peterson, I don't know, but I will try to find out.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bass?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's great to have you here, but I would sure like to have you each share with me something you're going to be doing that you wouldn't otherwise do but for this credit.
Again, one of the benefits to this particular bill would be to allow startups to take advantage of the tax credit. And in terms of purchasing equipment, where access to capital, as many of you know, is something that is very difficult for young companies. And providing this as a resource so that they don't have to necessarily be going out and getting investment dollars in order to be able to, enables them to retain the ability to have additional equity, but also to go out and immediately make those purchases. And things move fast within a lot of these types of these companies. So, you know, when you're doing research and you have needs for equipment and purchasing power for those types of things, the tax credit could be very invaluable.
And then if I could just add something real quick to that, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, kind of two different parts to my answer to that question. The first part is that I think the Smart Growth Coalition sees this a lot very similar to the 1984 unitary tax discussion when the state repealed the unitary tax, that it was a way to encourage additional investment from outside of Oregon. So that's one of kind of our philosophies with this proposal. The second comment that I would like to make on that is that it's an opportunity for those startups to be able to have the incentive to have angel investors be placing more capital into their projects here in Oregon to help them bridge the gap to be able to have a product that generates revenues for the state.
Yes, please. Representative Benz.
So the bill, as I read it, is not limited to startups. Am I wrong there?
No, that would be correct.
And so the question really is not so much the incentive it gives to startups as why we should extend it beyond that to those who are already here. We've already got you stuck in this state with for whatever bad choices you've made. Thank God we have you. Now, why does this make your presence here more productive than it might otherwise be? And I need specifics because we got to measure back why we're doing this.
I think that's a tough question to answer, in all honesty. I mean, would Tektronix be doing anything different in its business if it did not have a credit on the books? I would say no. I'll be on record as saying that. But here's the deal. You know, I go back, I talk to our CFO and our president, and I say, you know, look, Oregon, you know, is back in business. We've expanded the research credit. And, you know, let's keep our people here in Oregon. Let's keep them working, doing design work in Oregon. Let's not send them to China or India or elsewhere. And I think that communication is important, and I think it does resonate with them.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
And I don't want this to sound like I'm being mean, but times are tough, and we need all the dollars we can get for all kinds of purposes, notwithstanding the improvement here and there. But it was $1 million. This takes it to $2 million. So that would suggest that, but for the addition of this extra million, more people would be outsourced somewhere else. So I'm trying to get as a figure of if $1 million was good, $2 million is better, but does it take $10 million to keep everybody from going to China or wherever? We're trying to get some sort of a understanding of the measure of value that this has to you and then, of course, to us. And since I've worked with this over these years, I've struggled with understanding how this best works. And in my conversations with many, I've asked for this kind of metric, and I've yet to see it. So it would be very helpful to me if you could supply us with something that's real that would show why this is a good investment by the state. And more to the point, why this extra million stacked on the one that's already there is a value. There. I don't expect an answer now, but really do just need to see one soon.
Other Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, this might be more of a question for staff than for the panel, but I, along those lines, I was hoping that we could get a sense of who has been using this so far. You know, what companies have been using it so far, and to what extent. And do we have? I'm assuming we don't have a revenue or a fiscal on this yet.
I think
is there,
it
are
is
there
actually
projections?
I think it is actually a question for the companies and for the associations because the companies that use it file it as part of their tax return, which is not public information and not available to us directly. On the other hand, the members of the associations that are here have members that could release that information to the committee if they chose to.
It would be helpful to know who's as a part of these are the kind of companies that are using this credit. That would be very helpful for us to know in that ongoing conversation about how it is incentivizing it and to what extent.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to add on to what you were saying, Representative Smith Warner. There's two pieces of it, of course. Your question, I think, is perfectly legitimate, but the other piece that we don't yet know is if this were to pass, how it would affect
the refundable portion for smaller companies that don't currently have access. And that, of course, is very hard to predict. But I think for me, at least, that's one of the most exciting pieces of the possibility and how it could help those small and hopefully growing companies that can't now use it.
And if I may follow up briefly, to me, that is perhaps a stronger argument for limiting it to smaller companies rather than allowing it for larger companies. If the, not to call you out for doing us all the service of you being here, but if the Tektronixes are going to stay here without this, and it is indeed the small businesses that we want to incentivize with this kind of activity, might that be another way to think about it?
Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to go back and forth. My only point was
that, so fun.
It is. My only point was that it's a different statement to say who has been using it as opposed to who would use it.
Yes.
And I think there is value in large businesses too. I mean, the obviously, Intel is the largest private employer in the state, and we want them to continue to grow as well. So
know if they utilize this?
I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't mean to single out one or the other. I just meant to add on to your question to say there's a piece we won't be able to answer,
right,
which is who would use it.
Right. And indeed, that is my two questions are, who is using this now, and what kind of businesses and what businesses specifically, and do we have projections in the future for what the cost? And I get that you're saying we don't exactly know who would use it, but when we pass these kind of bills here, we indeed get projections from LRO of what the estimated cost would be based on their prodigious knowledge.
Right. And while we're talking about that, let me simply note that Chris has told me that the no revenue impacts that shows up on the SMS is not accurate, and that he has not yet prepared the revenue impact statement. Have I
correct
described what you said correctly? Okay. Other questions for this panel? I have a couple. Representative Bentz alluded to it. We have a policy that has been adopted in the last 6 years that requires the committee to explain through its statements, not necessarily in the bill, but through the statements that are prepared by the staff, what the purpose of a particular tax credit is, and essentially how it benefits the state of Oregon. Would you describe to us what reports, if any, the companies that use this credit make to anyone in a public way that describe their use of these tax credits and how it benefited the business, the jobs in Oregon, other outcome measures that might be of use to determining whether or not this is a useful way to spend money that would otherwise go to schools, healthcare, and public safety?
Chairman Barnhart, as far as I know, there's no company that has a disclosure of their credits either in this state or any other state, and there's no governmental reporting required other than what's on your federal and state tax return where you're claiming credits. I think, you know, the overall argument that we would say is that, you know, these are high paying, you know, jobs that are here in Oregon that, you know, certainly living wage jobs. I have no idea how this gets scored, you know, from a fiscal impact. I think I understand your concern thinking that, you know, there may be a revenue leak with this, but, you know, there's also, excuse me, the approach that many of us take that, you know, is more of looking at something from a, you know, dynamic modeling. And, you know, as I explained earlier, you only get a credit by increasing your spending. And most of that spending is on wages here in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Those wages in Oregon are going to get taxed at a rate you know is pretty high, 9-10%, maybe a little higher. The credit, if you get one for increasing your spending, comes back to a company at a 5% credit. It's hard for me to see how making this available to taxpayers and increasing limits, Representative Bentz, reduces income in the state of Oregon if you assume sort of dynamic modeling, that companies are going to seize upon the opportunity that's there in front of them and embrace hiring more people here to do R&D at wages that are very, very competitive.
excuse me, Representative Vance, please.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate your candor and your answers. I truly do. But but since we are spending the money, we need that type of foundation for continuing those expenditures. We need that kind of clarity. We have to have that kind of clarity. So, the questions aren't what I would call Kleenex, please. They're not.
Thank you.
They're not. We need your help if we're going to continue the tax credit. That's what I'm trying to get at, and it has to be focused. It can't be broad generalizations. There.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may comment on that, I think you're right. That is there indeed is a great economic benefit. There's also some cost shifting going on, and those taxes being paid are being shifted from the corporations to those individual taxpayers. They have jobs, and that's great, and they are high-paying jobs, and they individually are paying the taxes, and the corporations are paying less.
Another way of describing this, the same thing, our analysts are very good at figuring out that dynamic effect that you were just talking about. They work routinely on static effects, dynamic effects. They can figure out what the effects of different tax regimes might have. On the economy, based on models that we use that we think are fairly accurate, I think what we need is data upon which we can base the analysis that would allow them to make those that determination. And as I think you're hearing from several of us, we really need to be able to justify any tax credit that we give on the basis of what that credit is supposed to be for. I take it from the testimony you've already given us that you're interested, that you believe this will help keep companies in Oregon, that it will help new companies develop their products to get them ready for patenting and to get them ready for manufacture and distribution sale, and of course increasing employment wherever it is they choose to manufacture these things. That it produce income for individuals and for the companies themselves. I think having data that actually supports those arguments would be useful. It is clear to me that the four of you strongly believe that this is an important credit, that it's useful, that it's not only helpful to your businesses but also to the state of Oregon. What we would like is to have the information, the data, that will allow us to reach similar conclusions. We haven't got it yet. The information you provided is interesting, but frankly not persuasive because it doesn't contain that data. So having that would be extremely beneficial for us. I recognize that actually gathering it and putting it together in a coherent way so that our staff can use it to prepare those dynamic reports you were referring to may be tedious and onerous, but we're getting to the stage now in our evaluation of tax credits in general, the committee's approach and I think the legislature's approach, is that that we're trying to be far more data-based and less intuitive or experientially based or anecdotally based in our decision making. We have a slowly growing economy. If you were aware of the debate we had last week about school funding, you're aware that while there's a significant disagreement in the chamber about what the import of that is, everybody agrees we ought to put more money into schools, and that's an important not only for individuals but for business development as well in the long term. So that's what we're struggling with. And when you hear questions like the ones that Representative Benz, Representative Smith Warner have been asking, that's where those kinds of things come from. If you could provide us with data that would help us understand this credit in the way you do, that would be really helpful to us. I don't know if you want to respond to any of that today or you want to come back with further information later. And we'd be happy to hold the bill open for the provision of additional information in writing when you get the chance to do that. Anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony very much. It's very helpful to us. Chuck Sheketoff, Nancy Mattel, Marcia Kelly, and Jody Weiser, please. Please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chuck Schechtoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm here today in opposition to House Bill 2752. I've submitted two documents to the record before the meeting, and then during that last testimony, submitted two others, which I'll refer to and highlight for you. The credit is used to reduce liability to zero below the minimum tax by many of the taxpayers. One of the documents I've turned in was a report we released earlier this week showing that about almost 400 corporations in Oregon paid nothing in corporate income taxes because of the loophole created by the Supreme Court, or end run created by the Supreme Court in the Conway case. This tax credit is worded the same as Betsy, and so and that's why corporations are able to use it to reduce their liability to zero. I really appreciate the questions that were asked, particularly those by co-chair Bentz, and also the candor of Tektronix that they wouldn't do anything different, that it really wouldn't, because the money is going to companies that that research and development is in their DNA, and that's sort of what they do. And I would also suggest that for companies, except for the startups, which I'll get to in a moment, it's not an incentive. And here's my example. It's 5%, it's a nickel on a dollar, 5% of every expenditure over a base amount is how it works. So I have this calculation for the base, and if you're doing more research and development, we'll give you 5% back. I look at this committee, and I imagine that every one of you, I'm correct, gives money to some charitable nonprofit organization every year. I also imagine that none of you today are planning to send me and my organization $100. And I also imagine that if I say I'll give you $5 back, that's not going to change your opinion. It's not a nickel on a dollar is not an incentive to do something that you otherwise would not be doing. The credit pays for activities that's already going to happen, and Tektronix was spot on that. I think there's other priorities for the money, and I think that the questions and comments about that I've submitted to the record, and it'll show up in OLIS soon. Article from years back from the Statesman Journal. Garmin, the company that makes the GPS devices, but they also make things like the pads that the UPS drivers have and whatnot. They have a facility here in Salem out by the airport. And a few years back, about 10 years or so, you'll see on the clipping, they were expanding it, and they got some incentive money and whatnot, and they had a big ribbon cutting. And the manager said, "We like Salem. We get good engineers on the West Coast. We get really good. We like getting engineers from Oregon State University." And if you think about it, they probably have interns who are making the not too difficult commute from Corvallis to Salem to get that job experience, and they're probably hiring some of those interns or others from OSU. I can assure you that Ed Ray, with $1 million, can do a lot for innovation in creating more and better engineers than giving a tax credit to a company that's already planning on doing research and development. What's going to be used for? It is a broader range of research and development. So I also like to say I don't think we should be paying for Nike to get a patent on new dimples on a golf ball. That's not something that taxpayers should support. They're going to be doing that anyway. Increasing the size will only help a handful of corporations. I think you should ask the Legislative Revenue Office to give you more data on who's getting it by size of corporation. The data that's in the Department of Revenue annual report isn't good enough. In 2005, when the legislature was considering it, increasing it from $750,000 to $1 million, LRO calculated that only 6 to 12 companies would claim the full $250,000 increase to $1 million. That's only a handful of companies, some very large ones. The way the refundability is written, it can still go to some very large companies because it uses Oregon sales as the criteria. It's not targeted to small businesses as the prior panel suggested. Intel Corporation, to my understanding, has no sales in Oregon. You don't know what their apportionment factors are. Your staff does, but they're not allowed to tell you. DOR knows, but they're not allowed to tell you. But that's probably the reason Intel doesn't report its taxes that it's paying in Oregon like they used to before single sales factor went into effect. And so you can have a large corporation with very few sales in the state getting this tax benefit. So that's not the criteria for what's a small. If you want to target money for capital for research and development to small businesses, set aside the money and set up a grant program where you can tie it to them hiring people with certain hiring standards and jobs, and you can track the investment and see that it what it did, and you'll know who's getting it. This is the perfect program that should be that wouldn't pass muster at Ways and Means. Can you imagine what the Ways and Means co-chairs would say if Tektronix had the same candor to them, saying, "Give me money. It's not going to give me an extra $1 million. Now make it $2 million. It's not going to do anything. I'm not going to do anything different." They'd be laughed out of the Ways and Means room. And
I've been spending too much time talking to Peter Buckley, so I understand the point you're making.
So. You know, it's not a tax, the way it's designed, it's not tied to the jobs. They would have a hard time sort of proving to you jobs. You can run it through different economic models, but those are hypothetical jobs. They're not real jobs. And so I think there's just better investments for the dollars. That the expansion would cause, and even the whole credit if you had the gumption to get rid of it. Because I think if you look at one of the other documents I turned in is called the 2014 State Tech and Science Index, and it looks at all the different states about what they're doing. And not surprising, it's Massachusetts is ranked at the top in along a number of their indices. Why? Because of their investment in education. And a number of the states are ranked high because of their human capital investment and other investment in education that help with innovation. It's not just giving money to corporations that are a payback who are using it to reduce their liability to zero or less. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Taxfairness Oregon. You have my written comments, and there is a chart in there that shows how much is has been claimed, how many taxpayers, and the kinds of businesses they are in. That's kind of interesting. But given all that's already happened, I want to share a coffee story I had a few years ago. It was this time of year. I just sat down with two friends and said, "I can't believe it. I'm paying absolutely zero in taxes this year." And the two friends, not related, different families, said, "Me too." Now, one was a family with two kids and probably earnings of $80,000 a year. Three kids, two of them in college, and one of them in child care. So you could kind of guess why their taxes might be reduced to zero. The other person owned a software company that he had been growing for 20 years. So actually, the size of the research and development they did had been growing each year as the company grew, and they had never claimed the R&D tax credit. He said, "You know, I was always just busy doing my business." But along came a company that specialized in getting for you the research and development tax credit that you could get. And so the company offered to split what they got, and he took them up on the deal. And they reduced his taxes to zero. So I said, so basically the state and the federal government suddenly became investors in your software company because they gave you almost $1 million. And he said, "Yep." And I said, "Would you have given up a share of ownership in your company for that $1 million? "No way. No way." And yet what we're doing is being asked to invest in companies with the taxpayers getting no direct benefit at all. And for some companies, it could be an investment of up to $2 million a year, with the taxpayers not getting any share ownership. And in his case, and probably in many cases, that research was going to be done. It was a nice blessing, and he was planning on selling his company. He said, "You know, it's going to look really good on the records that I was able to take all this money out of my company while I continued to grow it." And so it included increasing the value of the picture of his company, but it didn't change what had happened at that business. And I'm afraid that that's what this tax credit does. And we've seen it, and when you read the research that's been done on the national level, there's the same kind of objection to it. You're really being asked to choose a shift. Who's, you know, is it child care for people who work at these and others' companies, or is it a benefit that, of course, the businesses will take? It's there, but it won't necessarily change their behavior. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, excuse me, and committee members, Nancy Metello with Taxfairness Oregon, and I don't know why I'm losing my voice, but it's probably okay because everyone has taken my testimony, including at least three of you up there. Basically, the money that is potentially being offered to these companies is money being taken from education, from infrastructure, from childcare, et cetera. This is not money that just comes out of the air, and I know you know that, but sometimes it gets lost in the excitement of making a set of constituents happy. I wanted to expand on what Representative Smith-Warner and Chair Barnhart were requesting, and that is that we need accountability. That's basically what I'm here to ask for. With any business tax break proposal, accountability is needed, and a lot of times it is not there. Specifically, who gets it now? How is it used? The effectiveness of the use, what actually happened with the increase of that tax credit? How many jobs might have been created? And lastly, some sort of performance auditing of the program. This is demanded of any grant that one applies for, and why shouldn't it be for legislation, too? This bill is basically a job killer from our point of view. That's a little startling to say it that way, but in essence, all of the money that is going to R&D would be coming from the education sector, from the public service sector, human services, et cetera. Those jobs are much lower paying than R&D jobs. So if you're to count jobs, it is a job killer. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we have one more. Marcia Kelly. Oh, just a moment. Why don't we'll take questions for this panel, and we'll hear from you, Marcia, if that's okay. Representative Benz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to kind of turn this around, we heard the other day from Congressman Schrader that Oregon is one of the least business-friendly states in the nation. One might suggest that this particular R&D credit does something to try to offset what otherwise is a pretty negative view of our business and climate. And one might also look a little deeper into what it is that makes it so unfriendly. And the business men and women that I represent suggest that Oregon is a great place to start a business, but a bad place to keep it. And this has to do with the income tax on middle management. So what you see happening is you see lots of middle managers moving to Vancouver. My suggestion and question to you folks is this. If this allows larger corporations to pay mid-management more to offset the income tax, otherwise causing them to leave the state, why is it bad?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, Co-Chair Bentz, so first I must say I disagree with my congressman. Because I don't think, it wasn't clear from that interview sort of what he thought was a part of the business climate. He made it sound like it was the minimum wage, the way the article was edited, and not taxes. But I think Oregon's got a great business climate if you look at how our economy's been growing relative to the rest of the nation. And, you know, in 1990, Forbes magazine declared St. Paul, Minneapolis, one of the 10 best cities in America. They said it's got high taxes on businesses and persons, big spending on transportation, education, the park and parks, the system works. That was their line and their saying. So I think there's other things that affect what's a good business climate, like the Garmin comment, we get good engineers. That's a business climate issue. There's nothing that guarantees that. First of all, I'll say there's a blog post, and I'll submit it to the record, because we were asked that question by a number of business people saying, we're really concerned about the middle management people, the people maybe with $100,000 of income. I have businesses that want to go to other states because those folks want to leave, and we showed why, comparing us to a number of states, that really doesn't make any economic sense. And I'll send that to the committee now that the record's kept open. And there's nothing in the bill. I mean, if you want to protect middle management, that's why you do a grant program. There's nothing in this bill that would guarantee that Tektronix who might share your friends' concerns or clients' concerns, that Tektronix would start raising their income or dealing with them, helping them better to keep them in Oregon. I've lost an employee because of the poor schools, and I know I'm not alone. And so, you know, I think there's a bunch of reasons people lose employees, and it's not our tax system. You know, I think if we have childcare more affordable for everyone, childcare is unaffordable for pretty much everyone, or a big pinch on everyone. I'm one of the people pushing for protection of the, as you've I think maybe heard the line, you know, it's more expensive than college, but you don't have 18 years to save for it, right? And that helps, that hurts everyone on the income scale, especially low to middle income families. So, you know, I just don't think there's anything in the bill that would guarantee that. If you want to get them to help middle-income families. If you want to help the startup businesses, and I understand they want to do research and develop, and they have to, but they don't have the access to the capital, set up a grant program that where you can get the accountable information that your colleagues want and that you want.
Representative Vance, right?
Yes, well, somewhere in there might have been an answer to my question, but I missed it. my question was, does this make Oregon a more business-friendly state? Not necessarily looking at the details. There are a couple things in what you did say which are interesting. I've heard, and I don't know if it's true or not, that Oregon is gaining 3,000 people a month that are moving into this state. So apparently the bad daycare and the bad schools they don't know this yet, but they're coming here. And so that isn't the issue. The issue is, what are we doing to give them jobs when they show up? And so one might say that anything we can do for business, no matter how badly we can measure it, is a good thing. And that was my question to you.
So is anything you can do for business, no matter how badly you can measure it, a good thing? The answer is no. Because you don't have unlimited resources. You need to use your resources more efficiently. You need to if you believe what will help innovation better is make so that we have world-class, on par with the state of Massachusetts and California engineering programs, I bet that'll help help with innovation better. There's other things you can do to make so that businesses want to be here. A better childcare system so that businesses can recruit employees and say, you know, you come to work for us, we have a good childcare system. You're not going to have to worry about you and the both parents working, what's going to happen to the young child. You're not going to have to worry about whether you can get the care you need. You'll be able to get it, and it'll be affordable, and it'll be safe and high quality. You can't say that today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Woodson, please.
Yes.
And I will note we have one more bill to hear and several to work. So
I just
go
have
ahead.
A question for Mr. Sheketaw.
I guess that's a statement to him rather than to you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
If you could tell me where the Oregon Center for Public Policy is on the House Bill 3246, the subsidy for green energy industry that we heard yesterday. I saw Ms. Weiser
Could we take that up outside of this hearing? It's really not germane to this hearing, unless you can tie it somehow.
Well, I believe it goes to the point of we are giving incentives or subsidies which take away from the revenue for the state of Oregon, and this is what they are testifying against, and I was just wondering where the policy group is on that, because yesterday it's what we're looking at.
Yeah.
Decreasing revenues for our state?
I think it's a really great question. Unfortunately, it's not germane to our topic today.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you so much, and we'll hear from Marcia. And while she's coming, I think it would be a great question for you to take up with Mr. Sheketaw directly.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, I'll be fairly brief. My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Unlike one of the young gentlemen in the first panel, I do remember the 1980s. I was unemployed because of a downturn in the economy, and I was in a service industry business. So I spent my time doing some volunteer work while I was looking for non-existent jobs. I even date back to the founding of Tektronix. My mother was a good friend of Miles Tippery, who was one of the four people who did found Tektronix with Howard Volm and Jack Murdoch. And so I saw the beginnings of Tektronix because we used to go and visit them at their little place of business when we were in Salem, or in Portland, excuse me. I've had handed out to you the tax incentives that have been passed since ballot measure 5 passed in 1990. This particular tax is not on that list because it came in 1989. So it preceded ballot measure 5 and 4750. And part of the reason I'm testifying on this bill is to remind you that as you give away money, you are making a choice not to fund higher education, not to fund other programs that would help train people and stabilize families in the TANF program. You're making a choice of supporting businesses that seem to be able to be supported if they've already gotten $1 million worth of sales in Oregon. The proposal in the tax expenditure book without the $2 million and without the refundability says that the Oregon credit would be about $15,500,000. That's not small change when you're talking about looking under every sofa seat for money. And I think there was an allusion in the first panel to tying it to the federal credit, which I believe takes another close to $30 million out of Oregon taxes because of the way that it's claimed on the federal tax, if I read the tax expenditure book the right way. So those are the things that I just want you to think about when you're making this choice, because we are apparently funding big companies. There are angel investors, there is venture capital, and there is crowdfunding for people when they're first starting out. So why provide this under the guise of helping people when they're starting out if they've already got $1 million worth of sales in Oregon? And I especially do not like the refundability of it.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Kelly? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today very much. There's my agenda. I still have it. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2752 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2099. Paul, go ahead. You want to describe where we are?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2099 is the bill that follows up on 2460 from the 13th session, addressing the issue of jurisdictions in which are located outside the United States for which corporations have to report income from subsidiaries located in those jurisdictions. We have, as you recall, last week we had a delegation from the Netherlands who presented a lot of information about the Netherlands and about international activities in general. You have a lot of material on OLIS from them, and they've been in contact with them. They've been in contact with the Department of Revenue as well. One of the things I did add, Mr. Chair, too, it related to that, at your request, was there's a reference to a tax treaty with the Netherlands. That actually dates back to 1994, and that is on your OLIS. There have been some protocols since then, but I did put that on OLIS as well for the specific tax treaty with the Netherlands. There are a number of other individual tax treaties, too, from the IRS that we could get if there's interest. So that information is being received and gathered. We also are getting other information, other material, and we're trying to keep that file going, but it's growing large. So let me know if there's any additional things that you're looking for. But right now, today, we have four people signed up for a public hearing on 2099.
Okay. Well, let's hear from Evan Hoffman and Ferdinand Hogerlin first, please. Gentlemen. If you'll state your name for the record and then give your testimony, we'd appreciate that.
My name is Evan Hoffman. I'm with the Organization for International Investment, for the record. Thank you guys for having me here today. This is my first time in Oregon. I'm delighted to be here, and you all have been so welcoming. I'm here today because my organization opposes House Bill 2099. We believe it will have a devastating impact on the state's abilities to attract foreign direct investment. OFFI is the only business association that exclusively represents the U.S. subsidiaries of globally headquartered companies. And it's really a rewarding group to work with every day because these firms make the unique choice to invest and create jobs here in the United States every single day. Firms like Daimler, Siemens, Nestle, Samsung. All told, U.S. subsidiaries employ about 5.8 million workers nationwide, including over 46,000 here in Oregon. They produce 21% of all U.S. exports and fund 15% of all U.S. research and development activities. And my favorite of all the statistics is that these companies pay higher wages. They, on average, provide salaries to U.S. workers that are more than 33% higher than economy norms across the country. So our mission as an organization is really simple. We work at the state and federal level to ensure the United States remains the top destination in the world to attract foreign direct investment. And we do this to ensure that our member companies, U.S. subsidiaries, are able to create and to grow and create jobs here in America. And we witnessed this just last week here in Hillsboro when Switzerland-based Genentech announced a $125 million expansion, creating 100 new jobs. That was a great win for the state of Oregon. We all should feel very excited about that. Which brings me here today to share our concerns with House Bill 2099. First, we are concerned that the tax haven list policy fails to distinguish between legitimate and abusive transactions. What I mean by this is the mere fact that a corporation is located in a particular country does not equate to tax avoidance, because they can be located in any of these countries for many legitimate business reasons, like manufacturing, conducting research and development, streamlining a supply chain, for example. But under the current policy, any and all firms that have operations in any of these jurisdictions will now face additional taxation by Oregon on what we believe is a flawed, overly broad assumption of tax evasion. HB 2099 exacerbates these concerns by adding Netherlands and potentially Switzerland to the list. These nations are two of America's most significant trading partners and sources of foreign direct investment, and they both have tax treaties with the United States. And what's alarming is that no state or country has ever added either of these nations or called any of these nations a tax haven before. And so by doing so, Oregon, we believe, is self-erecting a barrier to future investment flows from two of the nation's most pertinent sources of foreign direct investment. So let me give you two examples of companies that would be penalized under this legislation that have way more than just a P.O. box located in some of these countries. Nestle has operated in Switzerland for over 150 years. They have 11,000 employees in the country. They do everything from manufacturing food products to R&D of their new products. They would be impacted by this legislation. AkzoNobel manufactures right here in Salem paint coatings. They have about 70 employees here in Salem. Their Dutch-based parent company has operated in the Netherlands for over 300 years, and since the 1700s, they would also be impacted. So these are the very companies that states and governors travel the world trying to attract, but the very ones that will also be jeopardized by this bill. The bill would also undermine the U.S. tax treaty network, which is carefully negotiated between treaty partners to provide certainty to cross-border investors, to protect against double taxation, and importantly, to ensure that appropriate taxes are paid to each jurisdiction. I should also say that this bill would erode Oregon's competitive position here within the United States to attract FDI, because all other states that have looked to adopt policies that target abusive transactions have also built in legitimate safeguards to ensure that the legitimate business actors, the legitimate business activities that I'm talking about, aren't also inadvertently targeted by a bill that's meant to target corporate abuse. So we want to work with the state to ensure that the state remains competitive for FDI. My written testimony that I think you all have in front of you guys proposes language that we believe will maintain the state's ability to pursue abusive transactions, but will also protect legitimate transactions from being swept up by an overly broad policy. First, we propose language that will implement commonly used safeguards to protect legitimate transactions seen in states like Rhode Island and California. This would ensure that U.S. subsidiaries can invest in Oregon knowing that they won't be subject to unwarranted punitive taxation. Second, we urge the state to adopt what's called an effectively connected income standard, which is also used at the federal level and by states like New York, West Virginia, and D.C. This would align Oregon's tax methodology with norms across the country, positioning the state to remain competitive for FDI. Last, we urge the state to shift away from the tax haven blacklist approach to a tax haven factor test, which is used by Rhode Island, D.C., West Virginia, and Alaska. Only Montana uses the tax haven country listing approach, and they rank dead last in the country for foreign direct investment job creation. So the move to the factor test would allow the state to use the same criteria which the Department of Revenue currently uses to pursue abusive transactions, but optically would alleviate international implications that are created by labeling countries and jurisdictions as tax havens. So in summary, our member companies are extremely concerned about House Bill 2099. We urge the committee to reject this bill, and we look forward to working with you all to craft a policy that ensures Oregon stays competitive for FDI. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Ferdinand Hagroyan. I'm with the Council on State Taxation. COST is a nonprofit trade association based in Washington, D.C. We have a membership of approximately 600 major corporations engaged in interstate and international business. Our objective is to preserve and promote the equitable and non-discriminatory state and local taxation of multi-jurisdictional business entities. We share some of the same members as Evans Group, but also U.S.-based multinationals. House Bill 2099 follows actions taken by the legislature in 2013 to designate certain jurisdictions as tax havens. This is an approach the U.S. government has never embraced, and it's counter to current global efforts. COST respectfully urges this committee to abandon this effort to further target U.S. trading partners for discriminatory treatment and instead look for more precise and equitable methods to address any perceived tax avoidance. We believe that the branding of specific nations as tax havens, thereby penalizing companies merely doing business or incorporated there, is a counterproductive tax policy. Blacklisting specific countries, we believe, is overly broad and may result in double taxation of legitimate business activities. In fact, the blacklisting approach has been almost universally rejected as a means of dealing with tax avoidance strategies. Of the few states with any tax haven provisions, only Montana and Oregon have taken the blacklist approach of designating specific countries as tax havens through legislation. So to underscore that, besides Montana, Oregon is the only state in the country to have taken this tax haven blacklisting approach. It's instructive that the California legislature conducted an extensive examination of such a tax haven approach in 2010 and rejected it. So your neighbor California weighed the merits, and we linked the lengthy hearing record from that examination, and it's linked in my written testimony for you to take a look at their investigation and why they came out against listing tax havens.
And what do they do instead?
They examined their existing unitary combined regime, which is different than Oregon's consolidated regime, and it's something we'd emphasize, looking at your existing filing methodology and looking at ways in which perhaps it could be amended. But they looked specifically at the tax haven approach and decided that's the wrong way to go. The tax haven lists are derived largely from a list created over 15 years ago by the OECD to encourage countries to adopt greater transparency and information sharing about tax issues, not to broaden the tax base of member countries. Neither the U.S. nor any other OECD nation has ever adopted the tax haven list approach as a means for defining their income tax base. In the current effort by the OECD to address base erosion and profit shifting, or BEPS, the tax haven listing approach for defining the corporate tax base has not been considered. It's not part of the current international discussions. We suggest that Oregon's tax haven listing approach runs counter to current international work on the issue and the U.S.'s contribution to those efforts. So as we as a nation work with the international community, the tax haven listing approach runs counter to the current discussion on transparency and substantive transactions. Perhaps the greatest flaw in the tax haven listing approach is demonstrated by the choice now facing this committee, whether and how to adjust the list. The Oregon Department of Revenue has identified several new jurisdictions, including the Netherlands and Switzerland, for inclusion in Oregon's statutory list. It's not clear why certain countries are not examined in that report. For example, Montana legislation, which was left in committee earlier this year, that's not going to be adopted, would have expanded that state's list to Ireland as well. The tax haven list approach, I think, as this demonstrates, is a slippery slope towards a selective form of worldwide combination with significant implications for U.S. international relations. This interference in foreign affairs raises constitutional concerns as well. And as a result, we believe that the specific blacklisting approach will likely be subject to judicial challenge on constitutional grounds in the coming years. Finally, I'd like to note that notwithstanding the aforementioned international tax reform efforts, the BEPS effort, the U.S. states have extensive experience in shoring up the corporate tax base and addressing tax avoidance. These methods include participating in information sharing with the IRS, adjusting intercompany income, asserting alternative apportionment, and the business purpose, economic substance, and related doctrines. Oregon has these tools, we believe, at its disposal today. As you consider their use or alternatives, such as the proposed language that Evan from Offie has brought with him, rather than casting a blanket aspersion on entire nations and their international trade. I thank you very much for your attention today and welcome any questions.
Thank you. They have given us a lot to consider, but if there are questions now, I think this may be our shot at these two gentlemen. Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. It's very interesting to get what I understand is proposed a more nuanced approach to the rather blunt instrument of blacklisting. I'm interested in the approach that some other states have taken that you've highlighted in the memorandum about replacing it with a tax haven factor list. We had some discussion of the factor list under the DOR memo at the last hearing. But in terms of its implementation in statute, how does that work? Does it examine particular transactions as opposed to whole countries?
Yeah, the last state to move tax haven policy into law, whether it was the country list or factor test, was Rhode Island last year. And Rhode Island implemented a factor best criteria test. And my understanding is that, right, it's transactional based. Hmm. And so the DOR has the ability to look at certain transactions based on that criteria and then pursue those transactions if they feel right to do so.
Yeah, I see it as another tool for the DOR. So even the Multistate Tax Commission's model combined reporting statute includes the criteria and not specific listing, because there are other provisions in there that deal with unitary combination, the kind of income that's included.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? As I said in our private meeting earlier today, we're interested in making certain that income that is attributable to Oregon business activity, and that it, except for the way in which the Internal Revenue Code works to allow for the exclusion of income that would otherwise normally be taxable in the United States, that's our object, to be able to levy tax on that income under our normal rules. I can tell you for myself that I have no interest in taxing companies on income that isn't related to the United States and Oregon. We're going to examine the material that you've presented. Our object is to make certain that income that is attributable to Oregon is taxed. One comment I did not make earlier that I wanted to make sure you're aware of is that, as you know, there's been a huge amount of publicity in the recent past about inversion, a variety of issues having to do with intellectual property, removal from a country and income being artificially removed to a place in which there really may not be any business activity at all, as a way of reducing taxes in the United States. If the Congress of the United States dealt in a constructive way with those issues, we would not be having this conversation, because Oregon would be able to levy its tax on income that is actually generated in Oregon, because we are tied in many significant ways, including in the areas we've been talking about. with the Internal Revenue Code by state law. So one of the things that you gentlemen, because you have more access certainly than I do to people in Washington, D.C., could encourage them to get going with it. States having to do this work is not the proper approach. The federal government should see that its own tax law accurately reflects a business activity and income generated in the United States without artificial methods designed to avoid paying taxes here. That would be extremely helpful to us, and I would love nothing more than to not deal with this topic ever again. But in order for that to happen, the Internal Revenue Code has to be amended in ways that are appropriate, reasonable, and responsible. Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. We have one other witness two other witnesses who want to be heard today, Daniel Morris and Chuck Sheketoff.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm the research director for Our Oregon. Our Oregon represents individuals and organizations that care about lots of things, from investing in education to protecting the environment to helping Oregon's economy grow. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2099 and actually to encourage the committee to amend it to make it stronger. I've submitted written testimony with a number of exhibits. I won't go through all those. Thank you. In the interest of brevity, I do just want to talk about a few of the arguments that I've heard both at last week's testimony from members of the Netherlands and also in written testimony in opposition to this bill. And so there's three things that I want to focus on today that I push back on really. The first is that I heard last week the representatives of the Netherlands say that the Netherlands should not be considered for inclusion on Oregon's list because, and I'm paraphrasing a little, but because they're not just some little island nation in the Caribbean, but that they're a major economy. And my response to that would be that these two things aren't mutually exclusive, that you can be a major economic power and have a tax system that is set up in such a way to facilitate the abuse of offshore tax havens. And I think that the Netherlands certainly falls into that category. There have been a number of news reports recently. I've submitted copies into the record for you to read. This is actually a graph from the New York Times. And major U.S. corporations have been incorporating subsidiaries, paper companies, in the Netherlands as part of really massive tax avoidance schemes that have saved them billions of dollars. Google, Apple, IBM. There's a substantial amount of evidence that they're using these Dutch subsidiaries, and so much so that there's actually a nickname for this. So this is called a Dutch sandwich, in what this graph shows. So it's actually a double Irish with a Dutch sandwich, and the idea is that by setting up these subsidiaries in these other countries, they can take advantage of a nuance in the Netherlands tax code that allows financial assets to be transferred between kind of subsidiaries within the same kind of group of same unitary group with no taxes. And so even though the money doesn't end up in the Netherlands, the subsidiary in the Netherlands is crucial for kind of for this process of stripping out the tax liability. And so though the money ends up in some Caribbean tax haven, it gets there by way of the Netherlands. And so for that reason alone, the subsidiary in the Netherlands, it's kind of logical and appropriate to consider that as part of the reporting group when figuring Oregon taxable income. So that's sort of point number one. The second had to do with transparency and reporting. So we heard that that the Netherlands and other countries shouldn't be treated as a tax haven or for inclusion on this list because they are signatories to a number of tax treaties and that they comply with various reporting requirements and that they share information for law enforcement and for other purposes. I guess my response to that would be that it doesn't it's it seems largely irrelevant to me, since as Chair Barnhart mentioned earlier today, I think, and last week, that these practices are currently legal based on U.S. and international laws. These tax schemes that are set up are not technically in violation of any laws. So simply sharing more information about these practices doesn't by itself shut them down necessarily. And I think while I'd hope that we'd all agree that that having more information about corporate taxes and about the tax schemes would allow policymakers to craft better laws, to help shut down, crack down on the abuse of offshore tax havens, just by sort of dint of having a treaty in place, clearly is not has not been sort of sufficient so far. So to me, that argument is not very compelling. And then the third one I just wanted to talk about was this argument around nominal versus effective tax rates. And this is another thing I heard in last week's hearing, that the Netherlands shouldn't be considered for inclusion on the list because their stated tax rates are high. They're not like a zero or a low tax rate. And again, my response to that is that those nominal rates are largely meaningless if no one's paying them. The important thing to look at is not what the number is that's written down on a piece of paper, what their nominal rate is, but what the actual effective rate is of taxes that are paid by the foreign subsidiaries of U.S.-based corporations. And those are the data that the Department of Revenue looked at. They're published by the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. But it's those data that were considered by DOR when they prepared their report to this committee. And when you when they compared the amount of profits attributed to the subsidiaries in foreign countries compared to the amount of taxes that were paid in those foreign countries, the effective tax rate for the Netherlands is like 2.3%. And that's a very low tax rate. DOR, again, put in their report that they considered that anything less than 5% would be considered a low rate that would sort of qualify a country for consideration to be included on the list. And so we have, I think it's is it Barbados or the Bahamas Barbados, which is currently on our list, has a 5% effective tax rate. But there are actually five other countries with lower effective rates based on these data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis that are not currently on the list. And those are Ireland, the Netherlands, Singapore, Sweden, and Switzerland. And so I would encourage this committee to consider adding all of those countries to the list, and especially Ireland, actually, as we heard in the last panel. Given the prevalence of the of kind of this double Irish tax scheme that's very pervasive, so just in closing, I think the one last thing I wanted to say is that I think that Oregon's law is actually very well crafted to just target the offshore profits that are attributed to paper shell companies, and to actually protect the real incomes that are generated by real businesses, just because a corporation has an operation in a country that would be added to the list doesn't necessarily mean that their Oregon taxes would go up. So with that, I'd just like to say again, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Monday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chuck Shagatoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I promise to be brief. I think the chair is absolutely right. If Congress was doing its job, Oregon and other states wouldn't be having to grapple with this issue. But I dare say that I don't imagine that cost is going to cost benefit and their members benefit from Congress not doing their job. So I doubt that's going to happen. There's no correlation. One of the comments was, well, Montana has this, and look at the low investment. There's no correlation between their investment, foreign investment in Montana and that. Montana has this law, and they have lots of coal. Well, that's not a correlation there either. This bill, what I think is remarkable is that when you debated this issue and studied this pretty thoroughly a couple years ago. You know, a comment was made that California recently looked at it and chose a different course. Well, that sort of implies or infers that you haven't studied it. You did study it, and you made a good decision. And in fact, you directed the Department of Revenue to report back to you and how it's going and make suggestions for changes. And I, since being involved with this building since 1992, I've read literally hundreds of agency reports generated by legislative agencies or state agencies on related to legislation's implementation, and I will tell you that the DOR report was the most thorough and professionally done I have read. I was very pleasantly surprised by it. And I think it makes the case for the changes suggested in this bill. You know, there's also this sort of assumption that I'm hearing that, well, if it's going to raise taxes and therefore that's bad for business. Our taxes, as you know, you had a gentleman from Cost here. Cost does the study, which your legislative revenue office and our office believes is the best of all the different studies of trying to compare business taxes across the country. They do a study of state and local business taxes, and they say Oregon's got the lowest, the most recent report. A few years back, they did one looking at what's the business climate for investment. We were one of the best, if not the best, back then when that study was done. So, you know, but taxes aren't what makes reasons companies are here. I don't know about the company here in Salem that was mentioned, but I'm sure they sell product in America and they want to be here. They want the customers, and so they may have to pay a little more in taxes as a result of this bill. Maybe not. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get up and leave and give away the profits that they're making, they're able to make here and go to another country. Because if they want to sell here and do stuff, they're going to be paying our taxes. And last, I'll just tell you that for those of you who want to know more about the sandwich and whatever, there's a wonderful documentary that's free on Hulu called We're Not Broke that explains how Congress, what's wrong with the laws and how sort of virtually every large corporation you can think of or that you might deal with on a weekly basis are using these tax haven laws to get around, and does a good job of explaining the Irish situation and the Swiss
state. Please send the link to that to our staff, please.
I will.
They'll put it up, and I would encourage members to review it. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your testimony. Because it's been brought up by both of you, I think, are you aware of the agreement that Ireland and other European nations signed effective January 1st of this year to phase out the double Dutch Irish?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Davis, I have heard that there are, yes, I have heard of an agreement that you spoke of. I've also read that it's not expected to make much of a difference in, say, like Google's kind of tax strategy. So I confess that I'm not, I'm not a tax attorney, and I haven't studied the, specifically this new law in Ireland. I'd be very interested to hear, even if the new, any changes in policy in Ireland were to limit the availability of this structure for U.S. corporations to evade taxes, to avoid taxes, whether that would have any, practical impact on the actual sort of accounting practices of the corporations that are using those structures now.
Thank you. Representative Leininger, please.
Thanks for being here. I have a question about the factor test that one of the other gentlemen mentioned. Is that, it sounds like other jurisdictions besides Oregon and Montana are using that test to get at the same issue. Does it, do you have a view about whether it offers opportunities to us that might be attractive?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Leininger, I have not studied the factor test to which the gentleman was speaking about. My understanding is the way that Oregon's law is set up and the way that Oregon has kind of approached this problem is to instruct the Department of Revenue to make recommendations and for this committee to make the decisions based off of those recommendations, to not necessarily put kind of codify a series of tests in statute. And I think that's a decision I guess, for the committee, if that's the approach you'd like to make, whether to, I guess, to reserve the kind of flexibility and, you know, sort of ability to make that judgment call, or whether it's better to take these criteria and put them and kind of sort of write them in stone.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Whitsitt?
Yes, it's sort of a follow-up on the representative's question. Going to motive, why would California, which headquarters the major companies that you mentioned, Google and Apple, not want the revenue due them if these companies are, in fact, tax havens? So I'm asking, why would the headquarters of these major companies not want revenue they're entitled to?
You're talking about the state of California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it would be useful for us to review the report that they referred to.
Right.
I think that might be very handy. I've asked the staff to find the link for that for us so that we can do that.
Follow up. Obviously, they're getting money, you know, revenue that's due them through another process, I guess, is what I'm saying. Otherwise, if they weren't getting anything, it wouldn't make any sense if they knew that these were tax havens. So,
yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Smith-Warner,
thank you, Mr.
Please.
Chair. And if you don't mind, I mean, one of the things I will be interested to hear about what they discussed in California as well. I think just the fact that A, state, you know, not every state does this, period, and B, California has a much more stable tax structure than us because they have, well, among other things, they have a sales tax. And so because of our kind of not what everyone always says, the not three-legged stool, I would assume that would be part of it as well. But I think just the fact that a state decided not to do this, I would just say that that's not necessarily pejorative against the whole structure.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2099. Colleagues, we're going to hold over the work sessions that I'm about to recite until Monday. The work session on House Bill 2127 will be rescheduled. It needs additional work that we'll be bringing back to you later. So we'll carry over till Monday the work sessions on House Bill 3001, 2128, 2129, 2131, and 2148. Did I get it? I did. Okay. With that, thank you. The committee is adjourned.